Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 266, Digging Up Biblical History. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today, as we continue our series on the Bible, looking at the Bible from all kinds of angles, we're really excited to have as our guest today the most prominent biblical historian in the world. Now, I'm no expert, so don't take my word for it, but actually this might be a good time to mention, since we're doing this series on the Bible, that we have this other live streaming video show, which hopefully is going to become a podcast at some point. Anyway, it's streaming on our other project, Jewish Live. You can find it at www.jewishlive.org, and you can find any specific show there at the on-demand page. But the show that's relevant to our purposes is a different show. It's called Return to Torah with Richard Elliot Friedman. Richard Elliot Friedman is a very prominent biblical scholar, just like our guest today. He is the author of the book Who Wrote the Bible? And on that show, which is really wonderful, and you can learn a lot there, he constantly is saying that our guest today, Baruch Halpern, is, quote, the greatest biblical historian who has ever lived. So we are super excited to have him here today on this episode of Judaism Unbound. Baruch Halpern is the Covenant Foundation Distinguished Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Georgia. Prior to coming to the University of Georgia, he taught at Penn State and also at York University in Toronto. He has published 4 books, including The First Historians, The Hebrew Bible and History, and one of our favorites, David's Secret Demons, Messiah, Murderer, Traitor, King. In addition to his research and writing and teaching, Baruch Halpern is also the former co-director of the Megiddo Expedition and Survey of the Jezreel Valley. And I should mention that his books have won multiple prizes. We've been big fans for a long time and are super excited to welcome him here today to Judaism Unbound. So Baruch Halpern, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Pleasure to talk to you guys.
So I thought that maybe we could start. We've been talking about the Bible for a while in this series, but I thought it would be really interesting to talk to you about this question of history via the Bible, of how we think about both the Bible as history, but also, meaning, you know, you've talked about the writers of the Bible being historians, and what does that mean exactly? How do you think about that? And also, what are the limitations of what we can possibly know? And given those limitations, how do we think about, you know, is it really history because we can only know a little, or can we be more confident than that?
You need to know what kind of history you're asking about. I run into people all the time who say, is this history? What do they mean by that? Do they mean, did Abraham take a child up a mountain and hold a knife over him and see an angel? Because that ain't history. History, I think of it as my personal Dungeon and Dragon game. When I do history, I'm the dungeon master. And that's true of everybody. You're your own dungeon master when you're doing history. So you can have the dwarves and the monsters and the treasures and whatever you want in there, but you're the one who puts them there. If I am talking about the history of the United States, just for example, is the cause of the American Revolution purely ideological? Is it about liberty and freedom of worship and non-establishment of a state church, just general ideals? Or is it an economic issue because the beneficiaries of an ability to expand to the West was a huge inducement to revolution? And it depends why you're writing the history, because the answer you give is contingent on the question you're asking. If I add in that God came down from heaven to Thomas Jefferson in a dream and told him to write the Declaration of Independence, then I'm not dealing with history. Then I'm invoking a series of mechanisms that don't belong in my dungeon.
So I'm actually thinking about that example that you gave about Thomas Jefferson having a dream, you know, and I'm thinking, like, let's say that we only knew about Thomas Jefferson that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, but we surfaced some play from the early 19th century that talked about Jefferson having a dream that led him to create a new version of the Bible where he cut out all the supernatural stuff. And we would look at that and say, well, that dream, of course, he didn't have a dream about, or an angel didn't come to him in a dream, but gee, you know, if it turns out that there was a Bible that was found in Monticello and it had all these lines cut out of it. So maybe actually Thomas Jefferson did create that Bible, that version of the Bible, because that 19th century play talked about that Thomas Jefferson did it. It wasn't, you know, his wife or a slave or someone like that. It actually was him. And so I guess, is that sort of how you look at the way that we can use the material in the Bible to think about what things actually did happen, even though they might not be what the Bible says happened? I mean, I'm also thinking about, like, the Bible sometimes talks about its sources, like it's written this way in the book of the wars of Yahweh, you know, and it's like, wow, if we actually would find that book, that would be very interesting. And we would have some sense that there actually might have been a book like that.
I mean, it's a really good question. So maybe I can boil it down a little bit like this. Jefferson's Bible is an attempt to adapt the mythological and legendary and historical and liturgical and legal heritage of a civilization for a new circumstance. Whatever the historical degree of accurate detail in a text like the Bible, the thing was transmitted and preserved. These texts don't come to us straight out of the box in the original wrapping. They come to us through a series of transmissions and adjustments, like the adjustments that we make to law and like the adjustments that Jefferson made for an Enlightenment audience to the miraculous in the Bible. In a way, that's to miss the point of those miracle stories. And here we're really talking about the first five books. We're talking about the Torah. The Bible does not present Moses as a historical character. It doesn't present Abraham as a historical character. And what I mean by that is, it's really about the relationship of these characters to God. It's about how they are executing a divine vision. And God is a character in the narrative, just like they are. Well, in the language game of history, God is not a character. And that means that the use of that material is much like the use of the ideological explanation of the American Revolution. It is a programmatic text for attitudes that should be adopted in society. We are seeing an accumulation over time of practice, of attitude, of storytelling, Washington and the cherry tree, although that one's quite early. We see things creep into the literature that have nothing to do with history. And this all begs the question whether the literature was meant to report history in the first place.
I'm deeply interested in the question of, like, was this meant to be history? We've talked earlier in this unit about, like, what genre is the Bible, or maybe more accurately, what genre are various pieces of the Bible. But I do want to sit with some of those history questions, and I want to tie them a little bit to archaeology questions, because I know you've done a lot of work in both of those realms and in the weaving of those two realms. But I want to distinguish between two kinds of questions people ask. One are the genre of questions, the group of questions that I would term the did it happen questions. Were the 10 plagues real? Did a guy named Abraham go up that mountain with Isaac? Like, did Noah's Ark exist? You know, interesting questions, but I find folks are sometimes surprised when I let them know that, like, that's not what most biblical scholarship, at least to my understanding of biblical history, that's not what most people are looking at when they're doing scholarly work. The other genre of questions is not, did it happen? It's just more generally, what happened? And I think that difference is huge, because did it happen? The did is built on an existing notion of what happened. It's built on, there is a narrative. There's these plagues, there's this exodus, there's this, you know, journeying in the wilderness, there's this conquest later, there's these kings later, there's the all that stuff is sort of a story that we have. And then the question is that story true or is it not true or is it in between? The bigger, more expansive questions are just, there were people in this region. I mean, how we even define the region, it could be its own conversation, but like there's people in this region for a long stretch of many centuries that at various points had stories and at some points wrote those stories down and they became some kind of coherent text. What were those people doing? And that's different from were they doing this specific thing. And so I wanted to ask you not to answer either of those questions, the did stuff happen or the what happened, but rather like how do we go about in scholarly circles the answering of those questions? What to what extent do we look at written words and books? And to what extent do we start to go digging literally into the ground and look for answers in that way?
In Western culture, we have a fundamental problem with the status of history. History is used to justify things we want to do or attitudes we want to have. The historical explanations that we give do not have to be true. They're merely ways of satisfying our need for self-justification. When I explain things to my children, or at least when I used to, they were pretty simple and cut and dried. Yeah, Ted Williams was a great ball player. I don't have to mention what his personal life was like. I don't have to mention that he's cryogenically frozen. I mean, there are all sorts of aspects to the question that you're asking, because when the history is to serve as the justification for a myth, for an ideology, for attitudes, for, in some cases, behavior, it doesn't matter whether it's accurate or not to the person using it. History has this authority that in many ways it doesn't deserve. That's where archaeology comes in. It's not about finding the damn temple or the ark. It's about finding out how people lived, how society was organized, what was possible and how it was possible versus what was probably not possible. When I am told that the Assyrians deported 200,000 Judahites in 701 BC. When Sennacherib attacks King Hezekiah and deports 200,000 people according to his records, well, if I read his records really carefully, the first thing I want to do is go look for the 46 cities from which he said he exiled these 200,000 people. There are more than 46 settlements in Judah in 701 BC. Now, what if there had only been five? Like there are in 1100 BC. Well, then I would have to say that I'm throwing that text out. There's no way he's getting 200,000 people out of five sites, not these little cruddy sites. Oh, one of the great disappointments of Israeli archaeology is actually seeing how cruddy the sites are in comparison with everywhere else in the region. You go to Greece, you go to Egypt, you go to Turkey, and you've got these huge monumental constructions, and you go to Israel, and it's just, ugh. Which makes it more interesting, quite honestly. But the thing is, it's very much a question of understanding how that landscape works. And when I really look at Sennacherib more closely, and I see that he doesn't say, I deported them, it's just implied. And so I have to be very careful about the language he uses. He doesn't say, I deported them. He says, I counted them as booty. They're my labor force, is what he's saying. But he's not saying, I deported them, because he has people who are sitting there and who will say, what a liar, what a bunch of hooey. And therefore, these guys are more circumspect. They say, I counted them as spoil. It probably means that half of them ran away and took to the hills, went to the desert, hid. But it doesn't mean that they were all sent to Mesopotamia. And the same thing with the Babylonian exile. How many Jews are exiled in the Babylonian exile? The biblical numbers are really low. It's like 10,000 people. That's not the population of Judah in 586 BC. It's not even a tenth of the population of Judah. The Babylonians exile 10,000 people, and that is the Babylonian exile. we think of all of the inhabitants of Judah being sent to Babylon and living by the waters and singing those psalms. And the reality is, the text itself, the biblical text itself, tells us this was only the upper classes, the artisans and the government. When I look at the archaeology to ask a question, the question I'm asking is, what kind of society am I dealing with? What kind of numbers of people am I dealing with? How did these people get from place to place? How many hours a week did they spend in the fields? How many hours a week did they spend repairing their houses, which probably quite a bit? They had lives to lead, and they were organized in certain ways. And we think of government as being effective and surveilling a population, soldiers everywhere, even. And they didn't. Governments were as slipshod and as lackadaisical and as lazy and as misguided as they are today.
I wanted to go back to something that you said about the sort of, I forget the word you used, the paltry nature of the settlements in Judah, you know, in Canaan. Because I'm thinking about, well, the book that you wrote, David's Secret Demons, about the life of King David. And it's something that I'm always trying to wrap my head around. Given the findings of archaeology that the settlements were so small and that there wasn't so much impressive artwork or anything, it seems that the basic conceit of our view of David, that he was the king of some great kingdom, a united kingdom, it, even if there was a united kingdom, it was a united little nothing of a kingdom, right? And nevertheless, the story of David, this maybe king of a nothing, is still larger than life. So I'm curious both about, did it happen? What did happen back then with the story that we know? And also to the extent that things didn't happen, but they ended up in this glorious work of literature, what does that tell us about the people who wrote the literature?
I don't know if you ever had a hero in literature. I've had a few. One of them was Sherlock Holmes. The ideal that is encapsulated by a fictional character is no different than the ideal that is encapsulated by a historical character, because as far as your present reality is concerned, they are equal. Emotionally, we think, oh yeah, it didn't really happen that way. Oh, what a disappointment. But actually, as we live our daily lives, we are equally loyal to the image of a historical and a fictional hero. David becomes a giant figure. But when you take David and you look at what he would have had to have accomplished, how could he have accomplished whatever it was he did accomplish? And we're not sure what that is. One of the ways that he would have accomplished it is by making political alliances. Now, we hear about one of these in the Bible. We hear about his alliance with the Philistines. We hear as well that he was an ally of Saul's for a while, but that's harder to believe given the history of enmity that goes on there. What is clear is that the Samuel accounts are suppressing a great deal of material that they don't feel is pertinent to their message. It may detract from it. It may simply be irrelevant, but there's a lot missing. So how does a David go about persuading people, for example? Again, this is the archaeological side. Realistically, here's a guy living in a town, Jerusalem or Hebron, that has maybe 400, 500, 1,000 people in it. That's it. And he's going to suddenly conquer or suddenly compel or suddenly entice a region stretching from Beersheba to southern Syria to recognize his kingship. How does that happen? Well, it doesn't happen by his being local in Jerusalem. It happens by his going out and actively recruiting partisans. And involved in that are marriages of his children and his cousins and his uncles and his aunts to dignitaries. We're also told all Israel came to make him king. Now, no offense, but you couldn't fit all Israel into Jerusalem in that period. you know, and no offense, but if you look at all England went to fight with Henry at Agincourt, well, no, it's kind of a small group, this little band of brothers. The same thing with David. You know, what is all Israel? What does this language mean? So we have the historical game and we have the language game, which is part of the historical game. And how you interpret the language and how you get your impression of what actually was going on is a function of how sensitive you are to the genre. Is it mythological? Is it idealizing? Is it propaganda for David? That doesn't make it unhistorical. None of those things actually makes it unhistorical. It's a different form of language that you have to convert into our conception of what history is rather than their conception of what history is. What happens over the course of Israelite history is that you get a gradual progression from a less literal and more poetic conception of history to a more literal and less poetic conception of history. And as a result, history gets duller and duller and loses its audience. And nobody reads, you know, like Chronicles, forget it.
Yeah.
And that remythologizes, but poorly. There's a real clear transition over time from the epic mindset to the prosaic mindset.
I find myself just really getting called back to, I'm going to say, the trenches. You've talked about various wars, Revolutionary War. I'm thinking of, you know, literally digging in the ground, hearing you talk about the tiny little unimpressive sites in Israel compared to the rest of the region really caught my attention. And you've got this text of the Bible, and then there's all these gaps of various varieties. So then you've got a big set of gaps to fill, which hopefully sometimes archaeology can help to serve. And so I guess my question is, like, okay, the practical reality of, say, being one of the leaders of the expedition that you led at Megiddo, my question is sort of like, okay, so you're, I don't know, assigned to do that, or you choose to do that, whatever it is. Do you go to this place and you have like a mission? You're like looking for particular things, or you have a certain specific set of questions you're asking related to the Bible, or even not the Bible, maybe just related to the Bronze Age or the Iron Age. And you're like looking for things that answer those questions. Or are you just like, okay, here's a place. I'm going to go there. We're going to dig around and see what's there. And then we're going to reverse engineer questions that relate with those materials. And maybe it's a little bit of both, but just like, I really find myself, even as I've read the products of some of these expeditions, I don't feel like I really understand how it works. So if you could walk through like what that process is and the kinds of questions that you are and aren't asking, that would be very, very helpful.
Oh boy, did you put your finger on a weak spot? 9/10 of the time, the people who go to dig, who start digs, are archaeologists, formally trained in archaeology. And by and large, at the time they do start to dig, they're not really well informed about history. I don't mean that they don't know what everybody knows, because they do. What they don't necessarily have is a sense of subtlety in interpreting the historical materials. And so they will go and look for archives. That's what they're hoping for. In reality, the odds of finding an archive in Israel are, I won't say non-existent, but vanishingly low. And as a result of that, they go to these sites, the ones who are looking for something like that. They don't find the archive, but on the way to finding the archive that they're not going to find, up comes a figurine, up comes a house, up comes, oh God, a building they can't figure out what the hell it is. Up comes a hole in the ground that is there for no apparent reason. Once you start cutting in, the surprises and the quantities of material start to multiply. And this enables you to ask questions that you hadn't previously asked or possibly even considered. It's almost as though you went into somebody for exploratory surgery and found out that they were pregnant. You didn't know this. And you decide to noodle around and see what the DNA of the child is. It's an absolute crapshoot once you're cutting in. However, if you don't go in with a question, if you don't go in with an agenda for clarifying some sort of serious question, like social organization, in the case of cemeteries, burial customs, burial ideologies even. If you don't go in with that question, you're going to miss a lot of evidence, because you're always throwing stuff out when you're digging. You have to. there isn't enough storage space. Now, I swear to you, 200 years from now, we will be regarded as butchers for not keeping everything. Just the same as we look at archaeologists from 100 years ago who didn't keep anything except treasures. If it wasn't valuable to a museum, it wasn't preserved. So at least if I'm asking the question, what is the population that lived on this site? I can go in and save the bones, the human bones, and submit them for DNA evidence, for DNA analysis. If I don't have a question, I've got no reason to keep those bones except the conviction that 200 years from now, I'll be a butcher if I don't. We're constantly doing a triage. What are we going to keep? What are we going to pitch? You don't find exactly what you expected ever. And so, you know, all of the surprises reframe your questions. And then a guy shows up at your site, this happened to us, with a new dating technique for stones in walls. When was this stone put in this wall? Now, that's really valuable because it is a way of dating the wall. Guy heats up the stone, lets it cool, and measures the changes in magnetic north over the period of the stone's staying in the same position because the iron aligns with magnetic north over time. And it's accurate within probably about 100, 150 years. It's a little better than carbon dating in some ways. But it enables you to reframe your questions to ask very productive questions that you couldn't otherwise have addressed. If you don't exploit the information that you've got as fully as you can, you're doing a disservice to the field. We're destroying that evidence. You have to dig. And so you really do want to extract as much as possible from it. But on the other hand, you don't want to pay, a $200 billion storage fee to keep the stuff that you've pulled out of the ground, including the soil, for 200 years until somebody can do something productive with it. So it's basically always a compromise.
I guess that's the upside of the fact that you can, like, it always seems like sort of a little tragic to me, but I now see an upside to that. You know, there are these digs that have been around forever, but then they've only cut into a certain small part of it. And you kind of know, well, the rest is, you know, we've messed that part up, but hopefully in 200 years, somebody will do the other side in a better way.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, where I've seen this happen, and Megiddo was one of those sites where we went back to a site that had been dug in the 20s and 30s, really overly dug, too extensively dug. And we were able to check and correct the results of those earlier digs, as well as add new facets to them.
I'm thinking about two parallel questions. You could call it the question of the Northern Kingdom and the question of the Southern Kingdom. So the Northern Kingdom, it's sort of, I think, going back to what you were talking about at the beginning, that history, to some extent, what does history matter? You know, in a way, it matters. From a scientific perspective, you could say it matters because it's just information and it's fact. But from a kind of civilizational perspective, it's really a question of, like, what are you going to do with this history? And I personally have a fantasy. I mean, I have for a long time that I descend from the Northern Kingdom, right? Because okay. I would rather, that seems more interesting to me. Like, I'm more excited about the idea that I might descend from the North, because the Southern Kingdom, you know, that's been, everybody's from the Southern Kingdom. I'd rather be from the Northern Kingdom, right? And, so, you know, my question sort of from an archaeological standpoint in terms of the Northern Kingdom is, for example, you know, what have we found that was going on in the Northern Kingdom after it was destroyed? You know, meaning like maybe...
Great question.
Right? Right, like maybe, and like you're saying, the people went off to the Babylonian exile. I mean, I know that's the Southern Kingdom, but the people went off to the exile, but most of the people stayed behind. And then like the camera shifts to the people that went to exile. And I'm curious, well, what was happening among the people? And I'm wondering if a site like Megiddo is the site where we find out some of that information. And then after that, I guess I could tell you my Southern Kingdom fantasy and we could talk about that.
I'll tell you. There are different kinds of sites that are good for different kinds of purposes. That's another thing. You go and you dig a village in order to find out what village life was like and to find out whether the administrative structures of the state reached into the village and to find out what they were growing and how much money they were making, selling, what their surplus, whatever. But the thing is, a site like Megiddo, which is a major fortress throughout history, and the site of Armageddon in the New Testament. I mean, this place has a reputation. It's a terrible place to answer some of those questions. That's not the place to answer what happened to that population. The place to answer that what happened to that population is in 40 village sites. Not one, which archaeologists tend to, every archaeologist thinks that the site that they're digging at the moment is the center of the universe and answers all of the questions ever. It's the Higgs boson. I'm always working on the Higgs boson. Okay, but the reality is that if I had, you know, even 20 good excavations, really, really, really detailed, really, really slow excavations of villages, I would have a pretty good idea of what happened to that population in the regions represented by those villages. An example. The first book that I ever published as an editor of a series was by a really fine scholar named Zwigal, who had done a survey of the Lower Galilee. And he recorded that pretty much everything he visited ended in the 8th century. That is to say that when the Assyrians came through, all these villages disappeared. What that means is that on the fringes of the Jezreel Valley, the Assyrians really did get the population the hell out of there. And they stayed out of there, by the way. They did not come back. Those people really were deported. There undoubtedly were some that got away and went to Tyre or went to Dor or went to Transjordan. But pretty much the bulk of the population of the Galilee was wiped out, deported in 734, 733. This is very different from what we see in Judah at the end of the Babylonian exile. Almost half of the settlements of Judah that are occupied in the 7th century are still occupied in the late 6th, early 5th centuries, which means there's real continuity in Judah after the Babylonian exile, even though I'm sure these people were not staying put while the Babylonians came through. They still, after the Babylonians were gone, were living there. Now, by the way, in favor of your northern derivation idea, probably a substantial portion of the Israelite population from Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, from the hills north of Jerusalem, fled to the southern kingdom in the late 8th century, when the Assyrians came in the late 8th century, and were still being wooed in the time of Josiah, in the late 7th century, when Deuteronomy is published. And this is one of the reasons that you have all this legislation, I think, about treating Gers equitably, and especially in Numbers, about the Jubilee, or Leviticus, the Jubilee and the restoration of title to the families that once owned their land. There's a program here for the integration of the Israelite refugee into Judah as part of the workforce. The Israelite population, sure, most of it goes to Mesopotamia and to other places where it's deported, but some substantial proportion of it, 20,000 people, 30,000 people, we don't know really, but at a guess, 20,000 people, managed to find their way to neighboring states and particularly to Judah. Meanwhile, though, we do have a few settlements in the north after the Assyrians come through, where we've got completely foreign pottery, completely foreign housing stock. It looks like you're getting an adaptation of this material, or an adaptation of the villages for deportees coming from elsewhere. By the time the Assyrians disappear around 640, these people are all being treated as Yahwists, as converts, basically, or as Israelites, really, which we now call Samarians or Samaritans. And they're regarded as compatriots to the extent that they've assimilated by the Judahites. It kind of puts the lie to the genetic or the biological hypothesis of kinship among the Jews. They're as accepting of foreign populations as anybody else in the ancient world, which is pretty accepting. As long as you're producing agricultural goods or manufactures, and paying taxes, you're one of us.
Yeah. So when I think about the right, so when I think about the North, I want to know, you know, what really happened that's not in our stories. And when I think about the South, you know, the story that the Southern writers tell about the North is, oh, what a terrible place. There were all these assassinations all the time. Every kings would be like three generations and then they'd be assassinated. But we have this unbroken line of kings and we've never been broken. And that's where ultimately like the idea of the Messiah comes from, you know, the line of David. And now as like a 21st century educated reader, maybe not always educated in the Bible, I read, for example, the story of Joash, which is this baby, you know, supposed to be the descendant of the line of David, who is hidden in the temple after, you know, there's an assassination by someone happens to come from the north of all the other Davidic descendants. And oh, they find this little baby in the temple. And, you know, just reading that, you're like, well, of course he's not actually from the line of David. I mean, like that's just sort of an obvious political, you know, way to sort of claim that the story is continuous, but it probably really wasn't. And I say that with love. Like, in other words, I say that where I say, like, that is the genius of the Southern Kingdom. And it feels to me like, in many ways, that is the genius of Judaism ever since, which is this kind of willingness or even a need to kind of retell our stories so as to weave together these broken, discontinuous stories into a facade. And I say that again with love, a facade of continuity. And mm-hmm. So it's like, when I read Richard Elliot Friedman's book, Who Wrote the Bible, in 1987, I just remember that other people read that book and said, oh, so it's all BS, so forget about it. And I read it in a very different way. I said, oh, this is actually cooler than the story that we have. And I actually believe in this more. And it gives me something more exciting to be part of. Not so much that I've now learned the truth and I believe in that more. What I've learned is that my ancestors were really dedicated storytellers who believed that the writing of a story that unifies us is a powerful thing to do. And so we can continue to do that. It's not necessarily that if you find that the facts don't match the story, that should be devastating and disappointing.
Again, you're talking about the language game of history. And the reality is, we don't know whether Joash was in fact a descendant of David or not. We take sides on that, but there's no way for us to find that out unless we have his bones and those of another member of the family. The historical approach to that is, we don't know, but it could be either way. Or I should say, that's the professional historical approach. The ideological historical approach is to make him a Davidite or make him not a Davidite, which is equally ideological. Balance is, we don't know. How much does it matter that we don't know? Because either way, knowing, as they must have, that we could doubt the story that he was a Davidite, they told the story this way. If you want, they chose to believe the story this way. Even if the literal truth for us was not the truth for them. And I think that's, in a way, a different way of putting what you were getting at, that the answer doesn't have to be literally, historically accurate for it to be an answer with which we work.
I have a question that ties back to what you said about that Babylonian exile, because I'm both aware of that fact. It's not hidden that this exile that we talk about was a small group of elites. Like you said, it's in the text, and most people haven't even read the text, but like for people who have, like it's there. And yet, when we talk about it, we still talk about the Babylonian exile. And when we draw that continuous line of like, quote, Jewish history, which already that's not Jews, I mean, Israelite history or Judahite history, like when we tell that story, like Dan said, we turn the camera at a certain group. And so now I'm sitting here and I'm having a realization that I haven't had before, which is like, okay, so it is taken as a given basically in Jewish life today that one of the sort of thematic topics of Jewish existence that happens in Bible and that happens later and that even is connected to things today is the question of exile and the question of sort of dispersion and diaspora. If we shine the camera back on the people that stayed, all of a sudden you could make an equally valid claim, or maybe a more valid claim, if 90% of the people stayed and only 10% left, like you said. Like, you could make an equally valid claim that, like, there is a thematic Jewish topic to be explored that we haven't really explored yet, of what I would term survivor's guilt. Now, we don't have the story. We don't have people who wrote, oh my gosh, my friend was just chipped off and I wasn't, and oh my gosh, I feel terrible. But, like, is there any reason for us to think that a group of 90% of folks, of whom 10%, the other 10% were shipped off, didn't have some of those feelings when we look at history and we know that that's a common feeling in instances of trauma, that people feel that kind of survivor's guilt? Could we then take that and connect it to other moments in Jewish history like that? I think we easily could. I don't hear people saying, ah, there's a biblical story of survivor's guilt because 90% of people stayed after those exiles left. And so part of my question is, like, about that in particular, but my bigger question as we close this episode is, like, in what ways, when we look at those stories behind the scenes, when we turn the camera on the groups that the Bible's authors are not looking at, like, are there other storylines, are there other thematic topics that all of a sudden become part of our story? And I'm saying our intentionally. I know you don't come at this as, say, a Jew. You're in a scholarly, like, I'm coming at this sort of as a Jew. But, like, are there ways in which how we think about our own story in sacred, special, good ways, not in, like, oh, I'm dismissing the Bible ways, are there ways that it actually becomes really interesting when we specifically shine that light on the folks that aren't featured in the text?
The answer is going to be yes, but let me get there. The first thing is this. In a way, that question connects us to something that we don't really think about, and that is Jewish supersessionism. We complain all the time that other religions claim to have superseded Judaism, but the fact of the matter is that the monotheistic radicals, like Jeremiah, like the author of Deuteronomy, have superseded traditional Israelite religion. So one of the things that, yeah, does come to mind is, for example, that the Jews gave up child sacrifice. This was an integral part of that culture, probably until 622 BC, when King Josiah finds the book of Deuteronomy in the temple and banishes the practice, destroys the precinct for child sacrifice, called the Tophet in the text. What we don't hear are the voices of the people who resisted those changes. We only hear once from polytheists in the Hebrew Bible, and that is at the end of the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is sitting in Egypt with a bunch of people who have fled there from the Babylonians. And he says to them, speaking for God, this is exactly what I've been talking about, God being Jeremiah. This is exactly what I've been talking about. He says, you guys have never really, really, really reformed. You've never given up all those multiple gods that you always had. And they say to him in response, what the hell are you talking about? We had a reform. That was King Josiah they're referring to. And he eliminated all this stuff from Judah's public worship. He cleansed the temple. He eradicated shrines. He closed down altars. He totally revised Judahite religion to the point where it is only Yahweh that we worship now. But what happened? We got exiled. The Babylonian, everything went to hell in a handbasket the minute he did this. And so we're going to stick by our guns and we're going to worship the Queen of Heaven too. No offense, it's a logical argument. That's Judahite religion. Those people are missing. Now, what a modern sensibility says is, gee, yeah, there was the integration of the feminine into Israelite religion as well as the masculine, which is true. There was a goddess who was married to Yahweh. But that's not Israel. In the same way that the king of France can call himself France, in the same way that Harry in Henry V can call himself England, that's not Israel. Israel are the 10,000 elite who were sent to Babylon. Israel are not the people who went to Egypt. Israel are not the people who fled and came back to Israel. Israel are the 10,000 Judahites who were exiled and gave us Hillel and Shammai and Ezra and Nehemiah and you name them, they produced them. But the point is that, yeah, we have supersession inside Judaism as well. And you're seeing it today. And you will see it in the future. There will be changes to our myth as a result of the changes that we want to implement in conformity with modern sensibilities. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that unless you prefer in 100-degree heat fur hats.
Look, we end sometimes on notes that I didn't see coming, and that's a fascinating note to end on. Thank you so much, Baruch Halpern, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you, guys. It was lovely for me, too.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening to this conversation. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us, and there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. Third, you can check out Twitter and Instagram. Both of our handles for those are at Judaism Unbound. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you can send our way. And you can do that one time or on a monthly recurring basis at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.